Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Well, the congressional aide who wrote a Facebook post criticizing President Obama's two teenage daughters has resigned. In the post, Elizabeth Lawton, communications director for Tennessee Republican Congressman Stephen Fincher, wrote that Malia and Sasha Obama should have shown a little more class during the annual turkey pardon at the White House. Defenders of the Obama girls say, come on, they're teenagers. Give them a break. Well, we're going to take a closer look at that challenging time of life right now with a Temple University psychology professor who's been researching the teenage brain. Lawrence Steinberg's new book is Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Mr. Steinberg, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much.
And one of the things we should talk about right at the outset here is when you say adolescence, yes, it used to be only a few years long, but these days, adolescence, as you define it, lasts much longer than it used to.
Yeah, by my estimate, it lasts at least 15 years, partly because puberty begins so much earlier today than it did in the past, and partly because it's taking young people longer and longer to make the transition into the conventional roles of adulthood. They're staying in school longer, they're delaying getting married, they're staying economically dependent on their parents longer. So adolescence is a very long stage of development now.
Well, and how do you define adolescence as lasting 15 years?
Well, if we look at the average age of puberty now in the United States, for girls, they're starting puberty around 11 or 12 years old. And if you look at when young women are getting married in the United States, the average age is 27, 28 years old. So we're talking about a pretty long span of time and the same time interval lengthwise for boys as for girls. So we know that when people go through puberty, the sex hormones associated with that affect the brain as well as the rest of the body. So we can mark the beginning of adolescence in one way by looking at when that's happening. So that really is determined by when somebody goes through puberty. On the other hand, we can look at the end of adolescence in terms of when the brain is really not maturing so much anymore. And that seems to be going on until people are in their mid-20s or so. So I think roughly speaking, we can look at this period and bracket it as going from about age 10 till about age 25.
And one of the interesting things that you talk about in the book is that when somebody is an adolescent and has that adolescent brain and they look at a risk-reward situation, they're much more likely to focus on the reward, the possibility of a reward, than they are to think about the risk. So therefore, you've got people for a longer period of time, this 15-year period, making riskier choices.
Yeah, I think that this has very important implications for how we respond to public health issues concerning adolescence, for example. And one of the things I point out in the book is that our approach to health education, which basically is to point out to kids what's risky and how they should avoid engaging in those behaviors, doesn't really work very well at all. And one thing that we now understand is that one of the reasons that health education is so ineffective at changing people's behavior is that adolescence is a time when we're probably hardwired to take risks. And that is a function partly of how the stage of development evolved. In other species, other mammals, when the animals go through their juvenile period, they have to basically venture out on their own and look for mates. And that's a very risky proposition. So we think evolutionarily, we're built to be more inclined to take risks during adolescence than other points in time because it leads to this reproductive advantage.
Do you think that this 15-year period is going to expand further?
I think so for a couple of reasons. At the front end, some of the forces that are influencing the drop in the age of puberty are going to stay with us. So those are due mainly to obesity and to the exposure of kids to endocrine-disrupting chemicals. And there is some research that shows that maybe exposure to artificial light, particularly the kind of light that is emitted from computer screens and tablets and smartphones, are all contributing to lower the age of puberty. And these trends don't seem to be abating. Obesity a little bit, but I don't think there have been declines in exposure to the kinds of chemicals that are disrupting this. And certainly there doesn't seem to be any decline in exposure to artificial light. So I think the age of puberty probably will continue to fall. At the other end, The delayed transition that people are experiencing and going from adolescence to adulthood seems to be due mainly to economic factors. And I don't see the labor force changing in any way soon that's going to allow people to be successful with fewer years of education. So I think people are going to be staying in school longer, and that's going to contribute to the delayed transition.
And presumably the schooling that they get should be changed to deal with the changing nature of the students. So what should be done?
Well, one thing that we should do in school is to focus more on what experts are referring to as non-cognitive skills, and that would include things like perseverance and determination and grit. Because if you think about the challenge of becoming an adult now, you need to be able to stay in school for a very long time. You need to be able to stay in school through the completion of a four-year college degree in order to get a decent paying job. And that requires that we help young people develop the capacity to delay gratification and to persevere, even at tasks that they're maybe not so crazy about.
Your book is called Age of Opportunity. Many people may look at this and say, this is not an opportunity. This is a crisis. This is a problem. Why do you see it as an opportunity?
One of the main themes of the book is that we're discovering that the brain during adolescence is very malleable or very plastic, as neuroscientists would describe it. And what that means is that the brain has a heightened capacity to change in response to experience. Now, that cuts both ways. On the one hand, it means that the brain is especially susceptible to toxic experiences that can harm it. But on the other hand, it means that the brain is also susceptible to positive influences that can promote growth. That's the kind of opportunity that I think we need to think about in relation to adolescence. And it's an opportunity that I think we're squandering.
We're speaking with Larry Steinberg, author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence, excerpt at hereandnow.org. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Larry Steinberg, professor of psychology at Temple University. He's also author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. And Professor Steinberg, you say you remember your adolescence more than any other period in your life. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, so I have very rich and vivid memories of the people and places and events that were characteristic of my adolescence. And as I began working on the book and chatting with people about this, many people agreed that they remembered adolescence better than other periods, better than childhood, better than adulthood.
And when we say remember, give me an example of something that you remember from adolescence that you just remember more than you would at age 25 or 35.
Well, I can remember driving with my father to pick up pizza on Friday nights, and I can remember the feeling of the cardboard box on my thighs as I would sit in the car with it there, and the smell of that strange, weird combination of pizza and cardboard, both being warm at the same time. That's a kind of rich detail that I don't have when I think back to my 30s or my 40s or my 50s, even though that's more proximate for me than, you know, when I was sitting with that pizza on my lap when I was 13 years old. And it turns out that researchers who have studied this have found that most people remember adolescence better than they remember childhood or adulthood. It's something that psychologists call the reminiscence bump. The brain is particularly sensitive to experience during adolescence. It's like our sensors are turned up because of the way the brain works then.
So therefore what? What should we be doing with that information?
Well, I think that we should be paying more attention to the kinds of experiences that we're exposing young people to. In the same way that there's a lot of discussion now about 0 to 3 and the kinds of experiences we should be exposing young people to, very young children to, I think we should be thinking about adolescence as a second period of heightened brain sensitivity and brain plasticity. And I don't think that we think about it. I think a lot of parents and a lot of educators think that it's pretty much a done deal by the time people are adolescents. I don't think that is consistent with what we're learning about brain development.
What does that mean for parents who are worried about their kids drinking or doing drugs while they are adolescents? And the argument has long been made that if you're smoking pot as a teenager, it's going to be worse for you than if you smoke it as an adult.
Right. So we've been telling that to kids for a long time. I mean, that's what they told us when I was growing up as well. But now we have the biology to back it up. I mean, we have the science to back up the fact that exposure to these substances actually has a more lasting impact on your brain when the exposure occurs before the age of 15 or so than when it occurs after you're 21. And that's partly because regions of the brain that are responsive to recreational drugs are more plastic. They're more malleable during this time period. So individuals who start using things like alcohol or nicotine or marijuana when they're younger are 7 to 10 times more likely to develop an addiction than those who postpone the use until they're older. And we know that it's not just because the kind of people that start using drugs earlier are different, because there are studies with animals where they're randomly assigned to be exposed to these substances right after they go through puberty, and they are more likely to become addicted than animals that are randomly assigned to have this exposure when they're adult.
You know, a term that comes up over and over again when it comes to drug use, especially among teenagers, is peer pressure. And you looked at peer pressure in a lot of different instances in this book. Tell us what you found about that, about how the friends of a teenager can impact the decisions that they make in a different way than the friends of an adult would impact the decisions that that adult makes.
You know, I mean, looking back on my years as a scientist, I think this is some of the coolest stuff that we've actually ever found. We started by wondering why it was that adolescents seem to do so many more risky and reckless and foolish things when they're with their friends than when they're alone. And I think lots of parents can relate to this, that they look at their teenager and think, I don't understand how she did that. She's not the kind of person that would do that, but when she's with her friends, she acts in a very different way. So we decided to see what that was all about. We began with a series of experiments in which we had people come to our lab, and we asked them to bring two friends with them of the same age. And we then had them take a test battery, which included a lot of risk-taking tasks, either alone or with their friends watching them. Now, their friends were not advising them. They were just observing them. What we found was that on risk-taking tasks, adolescents took twice as many chances when their friends were watching them than when they played the same risk-taking games by themselves. But for adults, there was no difference at all. But we also found that when adolescents were playing these games and being observed by their friends, their brain's reward centers were being activated at a much greater degree than when they were playing the same games by themselves. And that the extent to which their reward centers were activated was predictive of how many risks they took. So we began developing this idea that what's going on when adolescents are in groups is that the presence of peers is so rewarding to people this age that it really lights up people's reward centers in ways that make them pay attention to the rewards of a risky choice and not pay attention to the downside.
I want to ask you about one more thing, Larry Steinberg, and that is that your amicus brief helped to persuade the Supreme Court to ban the death penalty for minors. Tell us about that and why that was important to you to get involved in, and how that fits into the broader point that you make in this book.
Well, that amicus brief was filed by the American Psychological Association, of which I'm a member. And when this case came before the Supreme Court, case Roper versus Simmons, the APA, American Psychological Association, asked me to head up a team of scientists who would pull together the relevant brain science and psychological science and behavioral science on how adolescents are different from adults in ways that should affect how we respond to them when they commit crimes. And as we began to look at adolescent development, both psychological development and brain development, it seemed to us that we could make the argument that adolescents are inherently less responsible than adults because they're still developing and their brains are developing in ways that are relevant to how we view their criminal culpability. So adolescents are more impulsive than adults, and they're more susceptible to peer influence, and they're more short-sighted. And these are all things that under the law mitigate your criminal responsibility. So we pulled together this evidence arguing that adolescents are less responsible than adults in ways that should ban the use of the punishments that we reserve for the most serious offenders who've committed the most serious crimes. And the court agreed and abolished the juvenile death penalty, which, of course, we think is terrific. We were one of the last developed countries in the world to still be executing people for crimes they committed when they were minors. It's hard even to get those words out. It seems so appalling. But we were successful there and in two subsequent cases in which the court agreed to place limits on the use of life without parole in sentencing juveniles for the same reasons.
But you still believe that the juveniles who commit crimes should face some punishment?
Absolutely. We've never made the argument that this exculpates kids from criminal responsibility. I think of adolescents as less guilty, not guilty.
Larry Steinberg, a professor of psychology at Temple University. His book is Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Larry Steinberg, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.